Thanks a lot. Thank you very much, Michael, for that generous introduction. It was actually during the workshop that I organized for you that the ideas in this talk actually started coming into place, and you'll see that, so that's interesting. I'd like to tell you about a series of problems I've been thinking about in mathematics that relate to the social sciences. And if there's one message I want you to take away from this talk tonight, that is, mathematics actually has something interesting to say about the social sciences, and the social sciences can motivate new mathematical questions. Okay. So there are many people who have been involved in this effort. Among them are students. Let me just see if we are actually, there we go. Several students at Harvey Mudd have been involved in this effort, and also some mathematicians at various other places. And so you'll see a lot of the work by students featured in this talk. So I'm going to start off by explaining how it is that mathematics actually enters into the modeling of preferences. Okay, so that's the first thing I want to do. And then I want to tell you a little bit about some of the theorems that we might draw upon to say something interesting socially. Then I want to tell you about a theorem, which we call the agreeable society theorem, that is part of the work that we've done. And then I want to talk about generalizations. So that's the plan. Okay? Okay, so first question, what is a preference set? When I say the word preference set, what do you think of? What do you think of? Greg, what do you think of when I say the word preference set? Okay, some kind of set of preferences. Okay, let's back up a sec. What if I just say the word preference? What do you think of? Just give me some sort of things from everyday life. Linda. Good. Things I like better than other things, okay? And where does mathematics enter into that? Well, I might want to, okay, so that's a very mathematical term, partial ordering. Yeah, I might want to assign some kind of value to some things that rank higher than other things in my preference, okay? So, so what about the word set? Well, many of you are mathematicians by trade, and you think of sets. As mathematical objects, but how do they relate to preferences? There's a question. So I'm going to show you a picture of a classic example that you've seen many times in the last election. A picture like this. Okay, country here is divided into two sets: a red set and a blue set. And those set express preferences. In fact, preferences of the states for various options. In this case, either Obama or Romney. Okay, and that's an example of a preference set because here we have some space, which is a space of players. In this case, the players in this interaction are states. And the sets are expressing preferences for a particular option. So states that prefer a particular option, I am singling out and calling them various sets. So here's the set that approved Obama. Here's a set that approved Romney, the red states, and the blue states. Everybody with me? Okay, so that's one example of a kind of preference set you might encounter in a social situation. Here's a second example. This comes from another area of mathematics that's closely related. And this is the problem, the classic problem from economics of how you divide an object fairly among several people. This is the classic problem of cake cutting. Okay, how do you divide an object fairly among several people? Well, one way is you might, for instance, look at a cake and ask somebody like, what's your name? David, asked David to express his preference over this cake. Okay, so what am I going to do? Maybe I want to divide this cake could be n pieces, but here I just have two pieces. And I say, hey, David, if I cut the cake like this, which piece do you prefer, piece one or piece two? You want the smaller piece? No! Yeah, well, he might express a preference, right? In this case, he might say piece one, perhaps, okay? But if there were a more normal person... What's that?
Did he say this to you?
You're going to say this? Whoa. Okay. Okay, so imagine then, and actually it's fine if you guys want to be contrary. It's okay. If I, for instance, cut the cake at a particular place, each person's going to have, if I pick a particular person, they're going to express a preference, either piece one or piece two. Yes? Okay. Now, here's a question. Here's the only place where the preference might, well, okay, for the purposes of this example, it might matter. If I move the knife, preferences might change, yes? Which piece you prefer, piece one or piece two? What if I move the knife all the way to the left and I ask a player, like Jennifer, which piece do you prefer? What is Jennifer going to answer? Piece one or piece two? Piece two. Yes, she's reading my mind. Yes. Piece two. Yes. And if I move the knife over here, well, you know, I mean, suppose Jennifer is interested in, you know, different people could be interested in different things. That's what makes this problem interesting. Okay? If everybody regarded the cake the same, this would be a very easy problem. Okay? But if I ask her somewhere over here which piece she prefers, and she, for instance, likes cherries, but she also likes massive amounts of cake, well, it might be a hard decision somewhere in here. But it's really easy here, if she's hungry. And it's really easy here if she's hungry, right? But I could mark all the places along the possible set of cuts where she would choose piece one. I'll call that set one, A1 here, this is a place where she'd choose piece two. So that's A2. And I could mark all the places where she'd prefer piece one. That's set A1, yes? And naturally, we'd expect A1 to contain a cut, the cut that's here, and A2 to contain the cut that's here, right? But anywhere in the middle, I couldn't make any predictions, right? Okay, again, two sets. What do you notice is happening right here? If I mark the place where a particular cut here, what are we saying if this point is actually in sets A1 and A2? Indifference. Yes? So you begin to see right away that intersections of these two sets correspond to points or cuts of indifference. Yes? That's a key idea here. Okay, so intersections are going to mean something. Okay, here's a third situation, which is a situation that I like to call what happens when you move into a house with lots of other housemates, and you're trying to decide where to set the thermostat. Okay? So you're fighting over where to, you know, some people run hot, some people run cold. How do you decide where to set the thermostat? Well, I could ask somebody like, no, what's your name?
Elizabeth.
Okay. I could ask Elizabeth, where would you like to set the temperature? And she says at 70. But then I say, Elizabeth, you know, you live with other people. They may not want 70. Are you willing to give me a larger range of choices? And so she might say, well, maybe she would pick some range around 70. Yes? Some interval around 70. Yes? So Elizabeth would have an interval. Dan would have an interval. Yes? Colm would have an interval. All of us would have an interval if I asked you, tell me your interval of places you'd be okay with setting the temperature. Okay? Everybody with me? Okay, so that's a bunch of sets, one for each player, and it indicates which options are acceptable to you, which temperatures. Yes? Okay, so now here's a question. Suppose I have all that data. Where should we set the temperature? Suppose I had a set for everybody in this room, an interval. Where should we set the temperature? They may not all intersect. If they did all intersect somewhere, that'd be the perfect place. But if they didn't, what's the next best thing? Hitting as many as you can, right? Find a point that's in as many sets as possible, right? Yes? Okay, great. So you see then here, again, intersections mean something. And one of the things that you'll notice in all these examples are the fact that the space we're interested in often has some notion of closeness. We call that a topology. Okay? So you can talk about close states, you can talk about close sets of cuts, you can talk about close temperatures. Okay? And one of the lessons of the work that I've been doing is the fact that this notion of closeness, the topology, the geometry of people's preferences, actually strongly governs what happens so that I can make predictions. Okay? Even if I know very little about you, I might know enough about you, for instance, that you know people are generally hungry, unless you're you or you, to be able to make a prediction. Okay? Okay, great. So just to give you an example of this, we're gonna do a little demonstration here. Suppose after this talk we all go out to dinner somewhere along Connecticut Avenue. Okay? And we have, let's say, 14 different choices arrayed along the street here, which I've imaginatively named A through N. Okay? And, you know, I might ask you, hey, where would you like to go? How are we going to decide where we're all going to go to dinner? You know, all 60 of us. How are we going to decide that? Well, I could ask you to vote. I could say, give me your top five choices. And if you just did that, you know, maybe Ron chooses this one, this one, this one, this one, and this one. Yes? Okay. Now, in such a situation, if all of us choose five restaurants and I know nothing else, you might, the worst thing that could happen is all of you spread out your votes among all these restaurants and we wouldn't be any closer to making a decision, right? What would happen? 14 restaurants, we're choosing five, then all the restaurants might get 5/14 of the votes, right? They might get about a third of the votes. Okay. But what if there were some reason that people's preferences were constrained? So Ron, you know, maybe Ron lives near restaurant D, okay? And he's really lazy. He doesn't want to walk very far. So maybe his preferences are an interval around the place that he lives. Are you with me? If I demand, or if by some constraint you guys are all picking restaurants that are in an interval, let's see what will happen. Okay? How popular will the most popular restaurant be? So here's what I want you to do. I want each of you to pick five restaurants that are next to each other. They're consecutive in this list. Okay? So for instance, A through E, B through F, C through G, etc. Yes? If you get, you know, J through N is the last possibility. N is not connected to A, so there's no wraparound. Okay? You with me? Everybody in your mind, pick five consecutive restaurants and raise your hand when you've chosen a restaurant chosen five restaurants, yes? Okay, so we're all participating, yes? Raise your hand. Okay, good. Put them down. Now, let's see how popular is the most popular restaurant. And before this talk, I actually made a prediction. So let's just see if it works out, okay? Okay, so I'm going to call these out in order and raise your hand when I call a restaurant you chose. And let's look around and see how popular is the most popular restaurant. How many people chose restaurant A? Restaurant B? Okay, if your hand was up for A, it should still be up for B. Right? Yes, five in a row. Starting. Okay. C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N. Okay, which restaurant was the most popular restaurant? J. And about what fraction of the people was it? If there were no constraints at all, the most I could say is one-third of you, about a third of you, 5/14 of you, would pick the most popular restaurant. But how popular was the most popular restaurant? Raise your hand if you chose J. Whoa, it's a lot of you, yes? A huge number of you. And before this talk, I actually made a prediction. And I predicted that the most popular restaurant would actually get at least half of the votes. In fact, it was way more than that, wasn't it? Okay, that was a fluke, for instance. But I could say it no matter what happened, that I could predict that at least the most popular restaurant would actually get half the votes. Okay? So what I want to do then is explain in this talk why I was able to make that prediction. Okay? That's the main message of the talk. So in order to do this, I want to talk about the model of voting that we've just participated in, and to do that, I'm going to motivate this by having you watch a video clip of an episode of The Simpsons. And in fact, this is an episode that aired in which year? 1996, right before the election that featured which two candidates? Clinton and Dole, right? Okay, good. And this being right before the election was also the Halloween episode, okay? So I'll just give you a little of the background. Basically, space aliens have come and abducted Clinton and Dole, okay? So these are really space aliens. Homer's up in a spaceship trying to rescue the real Clinton and Dole, okay? And what I want you to pay attention to is the commentary about our political system that that the episode makes.
Oh, no. What have I done? What am I doing? What will I do?
The politics of failure have failed. We need to make them work again. Tomorrow, when you are sealed in the voting cubicle, vote for me, Senator Bob Dole.
I am looking forward to an orderly election tomorrow, which will eliminate the need for a violent bloodbath. America, take a good look at your beloved candidates. They're nothing but hideous space reptiles. It's true. We are aliens. But what are you going to do about it? It's a two-party system. You have to vote for one of us.
Right, this is a two-party system.
Well, I believe I'll vote for a third-party candidate.
Go ahead. Throw your vote away!
Okay, who is that last candidate?
Ross Perot.
Ross Perot, yes. So if you remember, some of you may remember this, that Ross Perot ran in the same election and actually got a significant number of votes. But what was the commentary they were making? Yeah, he ran twice, didn't he? I think he might have, yeah. Right. Yeah, so...
All hail President Kane!
You can watch that later. I just need to switch over here and do it successfully. Right. Okay, good. So what were they saying about elections here? What was the commentary?
You don't really have a choice?
Yeah, well, third-party candidates never win. Well, rarely win, although we've had some recent examples, Lisa Murkowski being a counterexample in recent senatorial election, who ran as a third-party candidate. But rarely do they win. And what they're saying is, well, if you vote for a third-party candidate, you're throwing your vote away. So one alternative to the plurality voting that we're used to that's been advocated is something called approval voting. And in approval voting, the idea is you get to vote for as many candidates as you want, okay? And the person who gets the most number of votes wins. So you basically say, oh, if I have, you know, eight people in an election, maybe I like this one, this one, this one, and this one. And I'll vote for all four of them, okay? So they each get a vote, okay? Now, why would you have a system like this? Well, advocates of approval voting say that approval voting has many desirable features. First of all, in the plurality case, if you really liked Perot, but you knew Perot won't win, then you're being forced in some sense to vote for a candidate that isn't your first choice, right? Like voting for Clinton or Dole, okay? And under some descriptions of approval voting, if you model things right, you can say that approval voting is in some sense much better with respect to sincere voting rather than strategic voting, okay? Another thing people say is, well, if you knew this was approval voting, then you would be incentivized to try to have a big tent philosophy, so there'd be perhaps less negative campaigning. because you're trying to get as many votes as possible, and you're not trying to do that at the expense of somebody else. Okay. Many other features that proponents advocate. And now another thing is, if you were in an election like this one, you know, you are looking for the most electable candidate in the general election, you might want to know who has the most approvals, right? So that they could actually win in the general election. It'd be kind of funny if among these eight candidates, one of them won with just 13% of the vote, which could happen, right? Or if you're in my state and you have, you know, a gubernatorial election with one particular famous candidate, but this in this election, there were, does anybody remember how many other candidates there were in this election? No, it was like 130 or 140 candidates. In such an election, it would be really sad if we elected a governor who only got a percent of the vote, right? Okay, so approval voting is actually, it's not used in any political elections that I know of here in the U.S., but it is the method of elections that the Mathematical Association of America uses, for instance, to elect committees. And it's this model of voting that I want to discuss, okay? So here's how we're going to model it. I'm going to imagine that each person has a true preference for some position on a political spectrum, liberal to conservative. Liberals on the left, your left, and conservatives on the right. And but on the other hand, you know, they're willing to approve somebody who's in a neighborhood of their true position. Yes? So each person has an approval set that in this case is an interval on a spectrum. You with me? That's the model. And what we'll think then is if we take a bunch of people, we'll have a collection of intervals. Mathematicians like to make definitions, and so we'll define a society to be basically a space, which is a spectrum, political spectrum, together with a set of voters, and each of those voters has a approval set. Okay, so this is a society, there's a spectrum, and here are five voters. Yes? And now one question you might ask is, which platform is the most popular? So if I were a political candidate, and I was just trying to position myself to maximize the number of votes, and I didn't have any real preferences, any real political convictions, then I might place myself here, right, to get three of the vote out of five votes. Yes? Is there another one? Yeah, there's another one. Yes, there's more. If I have a set of candidates, a fixed number of candidates, can I make a prediction about the most popular candidate? Okay, that's the question. Okay. Good. So now I want to say a little bit about what mathematics we know that might help us, because you've already seen that intersections might actually tell us something. So what is the starting point here? The starting point is understanding what a convex set is, geometric combinatorics, which is this workshop that Michael's referring to. What is a convex set? Well, I'll give you a hint. These are convex and these aren't. So what's the difference? And don't say red and green. Okay, well, these are, they're blob-like, yes, and one way we say that mathematically is if I pick any two points in the set, the line between them remains in the set. That's true for any two points in this set, but it's not true for every pair in this set. For this pair of points, the line between them is in the set, but for this pair, it's not, yes? So this set's not convex. It has holes, or it has indentations. Similarly here, the line between these two points is not in the set. Are you with me? Okay, now, if you were thinking about this as modeling preferences, one way to make sense of this is, if I like this position and I like this position, I'd like anybody in between. Right? It's a very natural geometric constraint that comes from preferences. Yes? Okay, great. Those are what convex sets are. And here's a famous theorem called Helly's theorem. It's about 100 years old now, classical theorem from convex geometry. And it says the following. If you've got a bunch of sets, it could be 60, it could be 60 million. Suppose it were the case that you had convex sets in d-dimensional space. This is just the notation for d-dimensional space. And it were the case that every d plus one of those sets intersect. Then there's a point in all the sets. That's what Helly's theorem says. which is kind of amazing, right? So imagine here now, what these are sets in what dimension? Two, right? So it says that if every triple of sets intersect mutually, then there's a point in all 60 million sets, right? Strong local condition gives a strong global condition, okay? Okay, so now I haven't drawn 60 million sets, I've only drawn four, but let me convince you of why this might be true. Okay, I'm just doing a little picture proof here. Would you agree that, first of all, there are four sets here? Do you see points that are in triples? So if I pick these two sets and this one, is there a point in all three of those sets? Yes, there's a triple point. If I pick these two sets and this one, is there a point in those sets? Yes. And in fact, these are triple points in other configurations, yes? Do you see a point in all the sets? Yeah, it's the yellow colored point, yes? Great. Now, what's going on in this picture? Well, there are triple points, yes, but is there a point in all the sets? No. So why is Helly's theorem not saying anything about this situation? The sets are not convex. They're banana-shaped, right? So if we prove this theorem, we have to use convexity somewhere, okay? Okay, so now let me give you a sketch of a proof of why Helly's theorem is true, just to give you the idea for four sets, okay? For these four sets, okay? Here we go. Do you agree that this point is in both horizontal sets? And this one is too. Therefore, the line between them is in both horizontal sets. Why? Convexity. Do you agree that these two points are in both vertical sets? So the line between them is in both vertical sets by convexity, yes? Good. And do you now see that both these lines cross somewhere? That point must be in all the sets. Now, of course, you're thinking, wait a minute. Does that generalize? Because it worked for these four sets. How do I know if I take four points that I'm always going to get some kind of cross configuration like this? Well, the answer is it's not always a cross configuration. It could also be the case that you have three points that are in instead of getting two points that form a cross, you get three points and a point in the center as the two partitions of the set. That's also possible. And the reason that happens, it turns out, is basically due to linear algebra. Okay? It's related to the fact that three points determine a plane, but as soon as you throw in on a fourth point, you get some redundancy. Okay? And that redundancy can be expressed by moving all the things that have positive coefficients to one side and all things with negative coefficients to the other. And then you have an equality that turns out to be saying that this line crosses this line. Okay, those are the basic details. If you didn't follow that, it's okay. Okay, great. Now, that's Helly's theorem. But what does Helly's theorem say when the space is one-dimensional? Well, in one dimension, if every pair of sets intersect, then there's a point in all the sets. Yes? So any pairwise, finite pairwise intersecting family must have a point in all the sets. Okay, so let's just see some examples here. These three sets don't have a point in all the sets, but then they didn't satisfy the condition. Why does this not exhibit Helly's theorem? Red and green don't touch. Okay, here, red and green touch, and every other pair of colors touch, but what's wrong? The set's not convex, and there's no point in all the sets. Okay? So here's the example that illustrates Helly's theorem. Okay? And if you think now, this is a mathematical statement, but it has a social interpretation, then you could say, for instance, if you live in a house where every two people can agree on temperature, then there's a temperature that makes everybody happy. Yes. And let's see why that's true. Now, I've already sketched for you a proof of Helly's theorem higher dimension, but let me show you a proof that my undergraduate came up with. And, you know, when she came up with this, I thought, wow, that's actually really good. It was a three-line proof from her. Okay. Here's what she said. She said, Okay, well, we're on a line, and we have intervals now. So everybody has a low and a high temperature that are the endpoints of their interval. Yes? That's line one. Line two, since every pair overlap, would you agree that every person's low temperature is less than any other person's high temperature, even if it's this end versus this end? Yes? Because they overlap. Good. Well, then, line three, last line. Take the highest low temperature that's achieved by somebody, and the lowest high temperature that's achieved by somebody, this must be less than this. Yes? And therefore, because this is the highest of the lows, and this is the lowest of the highs, this interval lies in all the sets, as exhibited here. That's the highest low temperature right there. That's the lowest high temperature, and every point in between is in all the sets. 50, right? That's Helly's theorem in one dimension. Okay, great. So now, let's think about what this means for voting. You could imagine then having a society, which is a collection of intervals, and we'll call the society linear if the political spectrum is a line. A little later on, we'll talk about other situations, such as when the political spectrum is something else. Okay, a circle would be a circular society. But we'll call a society super agreeable if it has this very strong condition that every pair of people can agree on a candidate. Wouldn't you agree that's super strong? Yes, okay. And what Helly's theorem says is, a super agreeable linear society will have a candidate that all voters would approve. Okay? Okay, so this is what happened in that workshop in 2004. So I was teaching Helly's theorem. And, you know, and I have this thing for trying to connect math with the social sciences. And I go, gosh, you know, this would say something about voting, but it's kind of dumb, right? It's like, first of all, we don't have any society that's super agreeable on any issue. And that's a strong conclusion, right? We don't actually necessarily care if everybody's happy. Often we just care for making what? A majority happy or two-thirds happy, yes? So that was the beginning of the research question. The hypothesis is too strong. Maybe I can weaken this and weaken the conclusion as well. Okay. Okay. So that's where we were. And so I took this back to Harvey Mudd, and with a student, Debbie Berg, we started thinking about this question: how could we weaken this and still get a majority? And so here's what we came up with. We said, okay, well, let's call a society agreeable if it satisfies a weaker condition. So instead of demanding that any two people can agree, I'll say if I take any triple, some pair of them can agree. Okay? It's a weaker condition. And here's one thing you can say. I claim this is enough to guarantee that, in fact, there is a candidate that will get at least half the votes. Really? Yeah, in fact, if you believe this, then you'll see why I was able to make this prediction about restaurants. Because I asked you each to pick an interval, and you picked five choices each, yes? So among any three of you, how many choices did you guys make? 15. But how many restaurants were there? There were 14 restaurants, 15 choices. So two people must have picked the same restaurant by the pigeonhole principle. Okay, great. Why is this true? Well, here's a nice proof. It's sort of similar to Debbie Berg's proof. Let's just look at this collection of intervals. And let's look at the interval with the leftmost right point and the rightmost left point. So there's lots of left endpoints. Pick the one that's farthest to the right. Pick the right endpoint that's farthest to the left. Those are satisfied by two people. Let's call them green people. Okay. If the green people actually overlapped, then we're actually in the Helly situation. They all overlap, and it's trivially clear that, in fact, you get a point with all the sets in it, covering it. So suppose they're not. Well, then, let me take my triple to be these two green people and any other third blue person. So if you have a blue person and these two green people, and it's the case that society is agreeable, well, because the green people don't overlap, the blue must overlap with one of these two people. And if the blue person overlapped with one of these two people, it must overlap at one of these two points, because this is farthest to the rightmost left point, as farthest to the left. Any other interval must overlap at this point, or overlap at this point. And so, if you have a bunch of sets and they either overlap here or here, at least one of these points has half the sets. Again, that's pigeonhole principle. Okay? Ah, okay, great. But we can say something stronger. And so here's a stronger version. We'll call society KM agreeable if among any M people, I can guarantee that K people will have overlapping sets. Okay? And in such a condition, the conclusion you can guarantee in a linear society is a certain fraction, and that fraction is K minus 1 over M minus 1. So, for instance, in the Helly case, 2 out of 2, every 2 intersect, then this fraction becomes 1 over 1. All voters. There's a platform with all the voters. In the 2 out of 3 case, that's the case with you guys voting in restaurants, there's a platform getting half the votes, right? And if I had a 3 out of 4 society, 3-4 agreeable society, then there's a platform getting a 2/3 majority. That's the prediction that our theorem makes. Okay? Okay, so now what I'm going to do is give you a sketch of the ideas in this proof. So here's some examples just to show you that what this might look like. This, I claim, this society with 7 voters is a 2-3 society. That is, no matter which triple you pick, this one, and this one, these some pair overlap. Or this one, and this one, some pair overlap. Yes? Do you see a point that has at least half the votes? Make a noise when I get there. Oh, good. Good. Do it again. Yeah. Okay, good. Sorry. That's how I get my drills. What about this one? This is a one where among any 4 sets, some pair overlap. And you see there's a point, many points, to get a 1/3 of the votes. Yes? And this is a collection where among every 4, some triple overlap. So if I pick this one, and this one, there's a point in all the sets, in those 3 sets. Okay. And there is a point that gets 2/3 of the votes. It's right there. Okay? Okay, good. So now I'm just going to give you a sketch of how this proof goes, and the main ideas I think you'll be able to see. So the first thing we do is we convert this problem into another problem. Mathematicians love doing that. Hopefully the other problem is simpler, right? Or gives you some insight. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to turn every voter into a dot. And we'll connect 2 voters by a line, an edge, if what? If they overlap. Okay? So I hope you see that this picture represents the intersections going on in here. Yes? Okay. And now this is a collection of dots and edges, which mathematicians call a graph. We'll call it the agreement graph. Graph theorists would call this the intersection graph of these sets. Okay, great. Now, here's a question. Do you see the fact that there's a lot of people lining up here? Do you see that somewhere in this picture? How? Oh, yeah. We have, in fact, a collection here with what? All possible connections, right? A graph theorist would call this a complete subgraph, or a clique, like a clique of people who all know each other in some way, right? In fact, you see a big intersection here too, and that's given by this clique, which is a triangle, yes? Okay, good. So what we know is big intersection means a clique here, yes? But what we're interested in knowing, if we're going to actually do something with this picture, is if there's a big clique here, does that mean there's a large intersection here? Yes? No? Yes, why? Helly's theorem. If you just ignore all the other people, the fact that these pairwise intersect means that there's a point in all the sets, if you ignore these people or these sets. Yes? Okay. So, that's the first ingredient. Cliques correspond to intersections of approval sets. Yes? Good. The second ingredient is to take this graph and color the voters by particular colors. Now, why would you do that? Well, first of all, what does that mean? Well, we are going to try to color each voter by a color, and we just demand that if two people are connected by an edge, they can't get the same color. So if I call this red, I can't color 7 red. Okay? So now tell me, when you see a click and you color this voter red, what can you say about these voters? They're not red. In fact, they have to be 4 different colors. So you see that the number of colors you need to color this graph is related to the size of the largest click. Yes? In fact, it has to be at least as big as the size of the largest click. Okay? Okay. Great. So that's awesome. And in fact, for interval graphs that come from these intersections and intervals, something more stronger is known. The size of the smallest number of colors you need is actually equal to the size of the largest click. It's equal. Ah, okay. And if that's the case, then, well, let's just color the graph. And what we'll notice is the KM condition actually limits the size of the color classes. And I'll convince you of that just in the 2-3 case. In the 2 out of 3 situation, I claim that the number of voters colored red can't be bigger than 2. Because if there were 3 of you colored red, that would contradict the fact that some pair of you overlap. So, if every color has at most 1 or 2 people associated to it, there have to be lots of colors. If there's lots of colors, there's a large clique. Okay? That's the basic idea. Okay, so that's our theorem, the agreeable society theorem. And now I'm just going to finish up by showing you some of the ways we've extended this question, generalized the question. So, political spectra, not necessarily one-dimensional. This is a picture of candidates from a recent election arrayed along a 2-dimensional spectrum, authoritarian, libertarian, left and right. And I know what you're thinking. You're wondering, why are all our candidates here up in the upper right corner? And the answer is, this is a diagram from a European political scientist. And to them, all our candidates look conservative. Okay, 2-dimensional. So here's a question. What kind of hypothesis condition would you say is reasonable assumption for a 2-dimensional political spectrum? So there's some choices you could make here. You could certainly say, well, maybe people's approval sets are convex. Okay, so if you like a candidate here and you like a candidate here, you'd like anybody on a line in between. Yes? Now, there is something that you might be able to say that's a little stronger condition. And that is, instead of looking at convex sets, you might look at box convex sets. And a box convex set says, if you like this candidate and you like this candidate, then you'll like anybody in a box that's spanned by those points as diagonals. Now, why? Why would you consider that? Well, if the issues that you are arrayed over are independent, then it makes sense that if you like this candidate and this candidate, then you like these two positions, you like anybody in between. Here, you'd like anybody in between, and those things have nothing to do with each other if they're independent. So if the issues are independent, then box convexity is a natural assumption. Okay. Now, here's a reason why we might want a stronger assumption. It turns out for convex sets, they don't have the Helly property. That is, if you have all possible pairs of overlaps, it doesn't mean there's a point in all the sets for a higher dimensional sets of convex sets. But for box convexity, you do get a Helly-like condition. Okay. Okay. So here are a couple of results, and you don't need to worry so much about the technical notation. But what I want you to contrast is what's going on with convex sets versus box convexity. Okay. This is a box convex set, and basically the message from the work that we did is, you know, in the convex set, we actually aren't able to say anything that's very strong because we don't have this. We have to appeal to something called the fractional Helly theorem, but we're not able to say something very strong about the fraction of voters you can guarantee that will approve the most popular candidate. But in the box convex condition, you actually can say something really strong. Okay? So that's one direction we took this in. Here's another direction. What about societies where the political spectrum's a circle? Now, why would anybody model that this way? Well, this is also from a political science website. And the idea here is, you know, if you take the traditional political spectrum and you look at people way out on one end, they look, you know, radical, right? And way out on the other end, they look, you know, reactionary. And those people tend to look like each other, right? So this political spectrum's been closed up. Another situation is you might be, you know, if it's not voting over candidates, it might be voting over shifts on a clock, right? Who's going to take what shift? That's a circular spectrum. Okay, what can we say here? Well, the first question you might ask is, if you have pairwise intersecting sets, must there be a point in all the sets? Assuming the sets are connected intervals. What do you guys think? And people say, yes. Have people say no? Yeah, that's right. No, because this is kind of like the banana-shaped sets, right? Here you have all possible pairs of four sets intersecting, but there's not a point in all the sets. Oh, but you could still ask, how popular will the most popular candidate be? You won't get 100% approval, but what could you guarantee? In this case, you see three out of four line up, but is that a fluke? Or could we say something? And the answer is, yes, we can. You can, in fact, in the pairwise intersecting case on a circle, you do get a point in a strict majority of the sets. Okay. So that's kind of interesting. And there, we've sort of made this precise here. If they're connected or pairwise intersecting, then you get a point in all the sets. OK, so this is the version of the theorem that we proved. And I gave this talk a few years ago at a meeting. And somebody came up to me afterwards and said, oh, what about the KM case? Like, could you prove any results like that? And I said, no, we haven't. And so that person went home and actually proved a theorem and came back in a few months and wrote me and said, ah, here's my result. In the KM agreeable society case, you can actually guarantee a fraction. But what I want you to notice is the fraction is, it's similar to our result, which was k minus 1 over m minus 1 for a linear society. But this is now k minus 1 over m. So the fraction has gone down. You can guarantee less, yes? But it was a very nice result. And use some new techniques, because on the circular case, you don't have this nice Helly property. And most recently, together with a student and our president of Harvey Mudd College, who found some time to do a little bit of math, which is cool. This is a former student, and Catherine Nyman, who's at Willamette. We addressed a different situation where people's preferences aren't connected intervals, but they are allowed to have gaps. Okay, so we call this at most one gap. So we call this a double interval society. So here's a question. If you have pairwise intersecting double intervals like this, every red and every other color intersect, and any pair of colors intersect somewhere, not in both intervals, but at least one, must they all intersect? No. What fraction can you guarantee? Well, here's our result. You can guarantee at least 26.8%. And this was actually a bound that took a lot of work to get. But we actually conjecture the tight bound is a third. In every example we've tried, in low numbers of examples, it actually turns out to be a third. We first looked at, so this is just spread out, but these are all meant to be on the same interval. We looked at very regular patterns and found something that comes close to a third. And then by adjusting those slightly, you end up getting something that has approval fraction, a third. Okay, so lots of questions you could ask here. You know, what's the relationship of the topology of the space to the agreement number? What about non-convex approval sets? Probabilistic questions, statistical questions, how would I estimate KM for a sample, you know, if I had some issue I was looking at? And what predictions could you make from it? What are some other social interpretations? And just to convince you that people actually care about other spaces, just show you a few. You've seen a two-dimensional example. Here's a two-dimensional views of the state, right? State is good, state is evil, reason good, reason bad, and you have, you know, Nazis down here and libertarians up here and communists here and anarchists here. Okay. Here's a three-dimensional example. Liberties, personal, political, and economic liberties on each axis. Okay. That's a three-dimensional example. But, you know, I was hunting around, and believe it or not, I found a 29-dimensional example. A 29-dimensional example that millions of people actually care about. They log in every day. It's called eHarmony. And the point is to land in lots of people's approval sets. Okay, I hope I've shown you that social problems can motivate some interesting math, and math can model and answer some questions in the social sciences. Thank you.